Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to continue talking about treachery in its many forms. And the reason is that that's what's lingering in the air. That's what the truth wants us to talk about, it seems. So it seems like the topic just continues to remain. So we are going to share some stories that have been appearing in the headlines in recent days, and talk about a certain aspect, or emphasize a certain aspect of treason or treachery. But before that, we in the previous audio snippet, we briefly talked about Joel Osteen, the American Christian pastor who broke down in tears as he announced to the congregation that where he's at that they had paid off the building that they were in, and we shared, I believe, that there's nothing inherently wrong with buying a building or being happy that a building has been paid off and all that. But there's a certain emptiness to the significance of the thing when you think about the fact that they've been in that building more or less for 19, 20 years and for paying off the building, if I'm not mistaken, for a period of 19, 20 years. And it almost seems to match up against the period of time that the website where these recordings are posted has been up and running. And they've been able to build this building and fill it and have all these services and pay it off. Great, okay, wonderful. But as they have finished building that building, the country in that same time period finished off dying. So it's as if you're building a building and and the city or the neighborhood around you is being bombarded or being hit with the terrorist attacks or whatever, and houses are being blown off all around you. And buildings are getting destroyed and obliterated all around you. But you're busy with your house and you're building your house and laying down the bricks and raising the walls and everything. And then the final day when your house is done and it's finished and you can rejoice in your house being finished and having like a big ceremony, ribbon ceremony to celebrate the fact that your house is done. And as you're doing that ceremony, you're standing on the lawn of your house, you know, crying just like Joel Osteen. Oh, my house is completed and I've paid it off and everything is wonderful. But then you look around the neighborhood. As you look around the neighborhood, all the houses are devastated. It's all gone. The neighborhood has been totally destroyed. And that whole period that you were busy building your house, the whole neighborhood around you has been destroyed. And there's nothing left, and everybody's been left without a home. And that's where you are. And that's how empty the victory is. As they were building this, figuratively building this house, the country was dying, and instead of focusing on the death of the country and restoring it, they were so focused on their own house that they didn't realize it. It kind of reminds me, and these Christians should know it, in their own Bible, in the book of Haggai, it talks about God complaining that the people of Israel were all building these wonderful houses for themselves, these exotic palaces, But God complains there that he had no house to dwell in because the temple was in ruins. And the temple symbolized his dwelling amongst the people. And it's the same story. These matriarchal Christians, American Christians, were so busy building their church and their house that they did not bother to build a house for the truth to abide and for the nation to be restored and saved. So what was the point? And by doing that, they were derelict in their duties. And that, in a sense, in a subtle way, is an act of betrayal. So, for example, if a police officer is standing across the street and he's you're getting mugged by a couple of thugs on the other side of the street, and he's there and he's watching, he sees you, he's right across the street, he sees the whole thing going on, but he doesn't do a thing about it because he's too busy doing something else. That is a dereliction of duty, and in a kind of in a certain way is an act of betrayal, because he's betraying his commission or his duty to serve the public. And that's what the Christian church did. A very sad and dramatic, though subtle, act of betrayal by focusing on their own interests and their own thinking, instead of realizing that something needed to be done to save the country. And at the end of the day, that dereliction of duty is born out of a focus about, focus on self. It's all about self. When it's all about the self, then you are bound to be a traitor, because you're not going to be there when you need to be there for whoever needs you to be there, if you get what I'm saying. If you're about yourself, then you will commit dereliction of duty and engage in betrayal, even though you didn't technically do anything. Just like the police officer across the street, he didn't like stab someone in the back or go do some other sort of overt act of betrayal. He just didn't do anything, and that in itself was the betrayal, the deep betrayal. So that's an aspect we will be talking about, that aspect of when it's all about the self, then you become a traitor. You open yourself up to be a traitor, to commit treachery, and we will illustrate this with a certain person, and we'll share some stories that came out this week. So let me just go to the first story that we'd like to talk about, It was posted on thegatewaypundit.com on the 21st of January, 2024. And this was as a result of Ron DeSantis announcing that he was withdrawing from the race for the Republican nomination. So in other words, he's not going to try to win the nomination over Trump or anybody else to run for the general election in November. When I read and before I get to that to this story that we wanted to share, I believe this was Sunday morning, if I'm not mistaken, this past Sunday morning. The Sunday before this recording, I was by myself, and usually I have the tendency to talk to myself. It's as if like a thought comes into my mind and I start debating in my mind. This is not by myself. I just start talking. And sometimes I engage in arguments or debates with people who are not there, which may sound like a craziness, but it's as if it's as if a thought comes into my mind, as if I am challenged with something, and then I start debating, and as if I'm debating a literal person. And I think it's a figure of something in the air that's moving around, and it's like you catch it, and then you start reacting to it. And even though you're by yourself and no one else may be physically listening to you, when you're talking back, then you're releasing things into the atmosphere. And even if, as I said, even if no one is audibly listening to you, they will listen to the effects of what you release into the atmosphere. So there's always relevance in those internal conversations. The thing is that for some reason, I don't know what triggered the thought. I don't remember right at this moment, but something came into my mind, and as a result, it's like I became this reporter, this journalist or reporter that was interviewing Trump, and I was asking him about, and I don't remember what triggered this, but it's like thought came into my mind, and then suddenly I was in this place as a reporter talking to Trump and asking him questions. And one of the things I said was, you keep calling Nikki Haley a globalist and saying all these things about her. But you had selected her as the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. You were the one who picked her, and she was there for a while. And that begs the question, that raises questions about your ability to judge people's character. So what have you done, or what have you decided to do to fix the obvious problem of judgment of character that you have? And when I said that to him, in my mind, I felt Trump's reaction of anger, like, how dare you? And then he started calling me a member of the lamestream media, as he calls it, and as I also call it, a member of lamestream media, that you're attacking me because you don't like me and this and that and the other. So he was bundling me with everybody else who hates him in the mainstream media, and saying all sorts of things. So I doubled down and said, well, so you don't think you have a problem judging character? And then he replied, no, and all upset. And then I said to him, well, so you don't think that you made you clearly made a character error in character judgment when you put Tony Fauci as the in the forefront of the whole lockdown situation, when you made him the person that everybody would listen to for advice and quote wisdom on how to act on the matter. Do you admit that you made a mistake in judgment about him, and what are you going to do to correct that? And he got really outraged. Oh, well, I didn't know. Started saying all these excuses that was a person who had been in government for a long time and knew a lot about contagious diseases and so forth, and this and that and the other. He started giving me all these excuses, and then as if to say he didn't really make a mistaken judgment once he put Tony Fauci and Deborah Birx in the forefront of the whole thing. And then I went on to say, well, what about Bill Barr? What about the Attorney General that you chose? You clearly made a mistake, an error in judgment about him, because you, you've been very upset with some of the things he said against you. So clearly you don't have a good opinion of him, but yet you had a good opinion of him when you put him as Attorney General, and he clearly failed you very badly and didn't follow through on the investigations on election fraud in 2020. So do you recognize that you made a mistake, a very terrible mistake in judgment when you selected him as Attorney General? And what are you going to do to correct that if you are ever elected again? And he got really upset once more, saying that Bill Barr was again a politician, a person who'd been in Washington for a long time, and he had good references and this and that and the other, but he would never admit that that he had been wrong. And then he started attacking me as a member of the lamestream media, that and this, that, and the other. So at no point did he admit that he was wrong. And then I started doubling down and said to him, well, because he started going, how dare you? How dare you? Who are you to tell me that I'm a bad judge of character when I have started businesses and built buildings and done all these great things? If I were such a bad judge of character, would I have been this successful in my life? But then I replied and said, well, you asked me how I dare to question your ability to judge people. The thing is that you are my servant. You are asking me to hire you to serve in the office of the presidency in the White House, and as your employer, as your boss, as the one to whom you are to bow down and serve. I have the right to demand and question your ability to judge character, because if you don't have you're not a good judge of character, then you're going to do an awful job for me, and I'm your boss, and I'm your master, and you're my servant, and I have the right to question you, and I'm not just me, but I am speaking on behalf of all the American people that you are trying to convince to hire you as our servant in the White House. And when I began to say that to him, he just went ballistic. He went really ballistic. And I know this is you would say an imaginary conversation, but I know it was a reflection of what's in the atmosphere, the reality of him. So please don't dismiss this. Oh, this is just him, a conversation in his crazy head. No, it's a reflection of what's really in the atmosphere. I was really having a conversation with him, even though he was not there. And when I saw his reaction, I realized for the first time it was like a very shocking thing. And I was so amazed that it took me so long to see this, because it was so, it's so evident when you realize it that you are shocked that you didn't see it from the beginning. But as I saw his reaction and how he was getting really angry that I was putting him down as a servant, like he is my servant. It's like he's my water boy. He is the one who brings me, you know, my luggage. That's sort of attitude, because that's what he is. When he goes into public service, he is a public servant. And as a every servant has a master. Who is the master? The people. The people are the ones who are to be served by him, not the other way around. But I could see that he was getting upset that I, the weak, unknown journalist, pathetic little journalist, was daring to question him as if I owned him. And in a sense, I do own him when he is my servant, doing what I'm paying him to do, or I'm calling him, or allowing him to do. So when I saw his reaction, it's as if I realized for the first time, openly, this man is an elitist. And the reason why it had been so non-obvious to me all this time is that this man is, rides the wave of populism. So he is, that's the label a lot of people put on him, and with a lot of justification, that he's a populist. So when you see the label of populist, that you think of someone who fights for the people, who is constantly looking out for the little people, and who is defending the little people against the big powers that be, and because of that, then you tend to not think of him as an elitist, but in reality he is. Because he is a king. He's like a king an empowered king who at times acts like a populist, like when he goes into a McDonald's and he's been known to buy Big Macs for everyone, and when he's out at the campaign trail and you're shaking his hand and everything, and he's all smiles and everything. And I'm not saying that he's insincere or that his Big Mac free Big Macs are just hypocrisy. I don't think so. I think he really means it, but he does it when he sees himself as the big guy helping the little people. See what I'm saying? It's not that he becomes little himself and identifies with the little people. It's like he is the big guy helping the little people. But if the little people dare to say, hey, you're not that big and you're not that great, and you're not that wonderful, and I, the little one, can question you and say, hey, fix that, because you're doing that wrong. The moment you start acting like that, he's no longer the defender of the little people. Then he becomes this elitist who says, how dare you question me, you little filthy peasant. And that's when I saw for the first time that he was an elitist. And also in the midst of that debate that I had with him, I'm sharing this debate in a very kind of convoluted way. But when I was having the debate, it was very clear. Everything, I was being very clear and precise. I was hearing his responses very clearly. But since that all happened over a week ago, and it happened in my mind, that one moment, it's a little blurry to me now, a little cloudy. But the thing is that, in the midst of that, I also said to him, well, where was your, I have reason to question your, as my servant, I have, as our servant, I have reason to question your lack of judgment, because of the so-called vaccines that you promoted that are killing people. And how can we know that in future, you're not going to make the same stupid mistake and the same terrible judgment call when it comes to some other medicine or injection or some medical option. And he got really upset with that. Oh, I saved people, and I helped us to get the economy back on track, because it was because of the vaccines that people went back to work and blah, 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 blah. So he started giving me all sorts of excuses, justifying his decision to promote Operation Warp Speed and the so-called vaccine that's the blood clot shot. So the whole thing ended, and I came with this awareness that, my goodness, this guy is an elitist, and that's why he cannot, as the conservatives say, drain the swamp. As I've said before, the swamp is really conservatism. Because the swamp is a place of stagnant water, and that's what conservatism is. It's a place of stagnation, of being stuck in the traditions of the past that are not connected to the truth. And they just stick to it because it's the tradition of the past. And as we've said before, it doesn't, pardon my French, who gives a damn how long something has been believed? If it was just started to be believed yesterday, but it's true, then you should believe it. If it's been believed for 300 years, but it's false, why you want to believe it? It doesn't matter how long the tradition is, even if it is a tradition. The question is it true or is it false? That's all that matters. But to conservatism, having something that has been around and accepted for a long time just gives them this gooey almost unhealthy ecstasy that that makes them think, oh yeah, this must be true because it's been around for a long time and it's part of our American traditions and blah blah blah, and that's all they care about. So they are the real swamp. So I guess the better term would be cesspool, to refer to Washington. So let's use that term. So Trump cannot drain the cesspool because the cesspool is based on one. It has several pillars, but one of its foundational pillars is elitism. Elitism is what leads to the cesspool of the Washington culture. This group of people who feel that they're a little above or a lot above the average folk, and that they're wiser and know better than the average folk, and that they're there to lead the idiot masses to some sort of imaginary nirvana. That's what leads to the cesspool of Washington. So if you are like one of them, how can you eliminate them or defeat them? So there's no way, no possible way in heaven or hell that this son of a bitch Trump can possibly drain the cesspool, because he is at the end of the day an elitist, and he's proving it more and more with the days as the days pass. But the thing is that as I finished this debate, which happened very quickly, was bam bam bam, you know, I've been describing it for quite a while here in this audio snippet, but it was very very quick, back and forth, over maybe a period of 5 minutes or less. When I finished that, I said, okay, what was that? But at least I came with this awareness. Trump is an elitist. He may have the term, the label of populist, but if you peel off the populist label, below that it says elitist. He is an elitist. But after I came to that realization, I said, okay, so I took my mobile phone and I went to Citizen Free Press, one of the websites that I go to read headlines. And at the very top, it said, you know, breaking, DeSantis has dropped out. And I clicked on it, and it had a video on Twitter, or I don't know from where. But the thing is that it led to a video, the link. And I clicked on the video to listen to DeSantis. And I try not to listen to any of them because they disappoint me so much. I don't listen to Trump too much because he angers me when he talks. I rarely, if ever, listen to Bite Me. It's not even worth the time. And I don't like to listen to DeSantis because there's something about him that bothers me. But I said, okay, let me listen to what he has to say. So I listened to him, and I could see, how can I say this? A certain authority in the way he spoke, but the authority was like muffled with this matriarchal layer on it. I don't know, it's like there's a real man of authority inside, but it's muffled by this layer of matriarchal thinking. And it's like the matriarchal Christianity that he's grown up in and embraced throughout his life is like a muffle on the authority that's inside that man. And that's what I began to see. And that's why people see him so, like, so whiny and almost effeminate in some ways, in the sense of not having, not being manly, not having the authority that Trump exudes, the manliness that Trump exudes. And that's part of why he has had to drop out, because he never was able to remove that that kind of mantle of matriarchal, that matriarchal like sheet that's on him, or this thick comforter that's on him that is preventing the authority in him coming through. So that's what I saw, and I found that interesting. But I listened to him, and he was saying he was dropping out, and then he said, even though we have disagreements, Trump and I have had disagreements, and then he said, and it was very interesting, he pointed that out in particular, and even though we've had disagreements, including on the area of the so-called of the vaccines and the handling of the virus crisis, I choose to endorse him because he is the best choice out there. We don't want to go back to someone like, I don't know if he said it by mentioned her by name, but he kind of implied it at least that something to the effect of let's not vote for Nikki Haley because she is a return to a rhino thinking and globalism and old style politics that we want to get away from, blah, blah, blah. So he started endorsing Trump almost as if to say, we have no other choice. Like this, it's as if, yeah, I have disagreements with him, but all the other options are worse. So it's like, let's support him. And he also said, I had already vowed to support the Republican nominee, whoever he was, he or she was. So I will stand by my promise, blah, blah, blah. But so he was saying, no, I'm not supporting him just because I want to get on the bandwagon and I want to kiss some buttocks and be sure that maybe I'll have some position in his administration if he gets elected. There was none of that hypocrisy. It's as if he reinforced the fact we have differences. Definitely, we have differences, and I don't agree with him on certain important things, but. Obviously, I'm not going to win the way I'm running, Trump is the best choice available, at least from his understanding. So I understand his point of view. I don't agree with it. Trump is not the best. We can't have him in the White House again. It's as simple as that. It's going to be a disaster. And this kind of thinking, or let's just go with the quote least worst option. That's what led us to where we are now, and to the country being dead. But that aside, it really doesn't matter who wins, who doesn't win anyway. The country's dead, so the whole point is moved to a certain extent. But what drew my but the thing is, as he continued to talk, he started giving a bit of a vision. Of what he wanted, what he believed in, and he started saying, as he was criticizing Nikki Haley, I believe by name or implicitly, he was saying we don't want a government that where the people in government in power think that they are to be served by the people. No, we need a government. That knows that they are the servants of the people. And when he said that, maybe not in those exact words, but he said servant and all that. So as he was saying that, it's like, my goodness, that's exactly what I was just saying to Trump a few seconds ago in that internal mental debate that I had with him. And the fact that he pointed out how Trump and his judgment on the vaccines and whole the. Oh, and he mentioned Tony Fauci by name. He said, and I disagree with him putting Tony Fauci in charge of the whole thing. And when he said those things, it's like, oh my goodness, it's like he had listened to the debate that I had just had with Trump and was repeating the same ideas, the idea that this emphasis, you, Trump, are here to be our servant, our water boy, not to be our king. And our master, and you have to get out of that mentality if you want to really affect change. And he was saying that, and then he also questioned the lack of judgment. And he mentioned Tony Fauci by name, and he's one of the persons that I brought up in my quick internal debate with Trump. It's as if he was, and that was kind of a significant moment for me. And I realized, oh my goodness, it's so sad because. DeSantis is probably the closest that there was to anyone out there listening to the truth. Because it's as if he had heard that debate that I had just had. Obviously, the video was recorded before I had the debate, but I hope you see what I'm trying to say. It's as if he was listening to the... His ears are perked up towards the truth. He's still not quite hearing the whole thing, but he's listening way more than Trump ever will. Sadly, he... didn't know how to break out of the matriarchal comforter that's that's smothering him and kind of muffling the authority, the male authority that's in him. And that comes from the matriarchal Christian stuff. If the matriarchal Christian church had woken up to the truth, I am pretty certain that would have woken up a tiger or a lion. I don't know why I said tiger. I don't know why that seems so fitting with him, with DeSantis. That it would have woken up the tiger in him to fight and manifest an authority and a nature that that's in there, but it's not manifested because of that matriarchal sheet around him. I don't know how to explain this. Like there's this sheet or this comforter, very thick comforter, smothering him around him. But so the story we wanted to get to, posted on the 21st of January on the gatewaypundit.com, reads the headline, Trump announces, quote, Ron DeSanctimonious, unquote, nickname, quote, officially retired, unquote. So, I personally, if I had been DeSantis, I would have brought that up, you know, that despite his lack of respect for me and for slandering me and accusing me of things that were not true, I endorse it. But, I would have brought up, I'm not happy with him calling me DeSanctimonious. That can't just go unnoticed. And you know why I was calling him DeSanctimonious? Because like me, the little reporter who was questioning him and making him kind of force him to think about the stupid mistake he's made in the past, because he was acting like that little reporter, me in this case, questioning him, that's when the elitist, arrogant elitist Trump felt like looking down on this little DeSanctimonious and saying, you know, how arrogant of you to lecture me on what is right and what is wrong. That's why he was calling him Sanctimonious. Like, how dare you preach to me and tell me what I'm doing right and what I'm doing wrong. And that became very clear when I realized he's an elitist. That's why he talks the way he talks. And that's why he calls people the way he calls them. So it says here, President Donald Trump has announced that he is officially retiring the moniker Ron DeSanctimonious that he had previously used for Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Oh, and by the way, as we've mentioned before, part of the anger towards DeSantis was this little one that I helped to become governor of Florida. It was because of me that he became governor of Florida. He was a nobody until I came along and endorsed him. How dare him not return the favor and honor me, his master, his mafia boss, and how dare he challenge me in the primary debate, primary race, when I'm clearly the best choice for the country. Because obviously, Trump has never done any sort of self-examination to figure out if he ever did anything wrong. It's always someone else's fault. So it says here, former President Donald Trump first used the nickname Ron DeSanctimonious for Ron DeSantis on November 5th, 2022, 3 days before the midterm. This occurred during a rally in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, where Trump was stumping for Pennsylvania gubernatorial candidate Doug Mastriano and Senate candidate Mehmet Oz. He mentioned this nickname while discussing his standing in the polls for the potential 2024 Republican primary nomination. And so it's interesting now that I look at this. He was he started this when he was campaigning for Mehmet Oz, and if I remember correctly, Mehmet Oz is a rhino politician. So he's willing to support a rhino. But at the same time, he attacks someone who is anything but a rhino, and tried to destroy him and ridicule him just because he's daring to run against him. So see the theme there. Everything is about him. Everything is about him. You mess with him, and then you're the spawn of Satan. You stop messing with him, and suddenly all the bad things he thought about you went away. Well, is he still sanctimonious or not? Did he stop being sanctimonious just because he dropped out of the race? Is that all that you had against him, Trump? See, and that's what tells you that why he's a terrible judge of character. Because a judge of character judges someone and says he's good, he's bad, because of what he is. See, it's like if a car is red, it's red. You look away and it doesn't stop being red. And you look back, then you see it's red again. Whether the car is coming towards you or driving away from you, it's still red. It doesn't matter what the car is doing. If the car is trying to hit you, it's still red. If the car is not trying to hit you, it's still red. See, it's something objective and independent. It's a reality that's there. And if you're a judge of color, taking that as the analogy, then you will look at the car and judge it to be red. And it's red, and it continues to be red until someone comes and paints it a different color. So clearly, he was saying, supposedly being the incredible judge of character that he is, he was looking at DeSantis and saying, there's sanctimony in him. Oh, yes, I hear sanctimony in his voice. So, but suddenly he decides not to run anymore against him. And all that sanctimony that he could see in his character suddenly went away. And that tells you why he's a terrible judge of character, because he judges the character based on how you treat him. If you treat him nice and pat him on the back and say how wonderful he is, then suddenly you're the greatest person in the history of mankind. But you dare to question him, you dare to challenge him, and suddenly you are a terrible, as Charles Barkley would say, terrible, 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 terrible person. And that's how he judges people. No wonder he's such a terrible judge of character. And he doesn't understand it, doesn't realize that, doesn't want to see it. Because if you bring it up, immediately you are evil. So no one can ever tell him how terrible he is at it and show it to him. You know, hey, Trump, these are the mistakes you're making when judging character. Because the moment you start doing that, he immediately labels you as a member of the mainstream media, as a crazy radical leftist, and throws you out the window. He defenestrates you because he is not going to listen to anyone who comes against him, what he perceives to be him. And he's always had this, but it was more under control when he still had a calling in him, when the truth had his eye, when the truth's eyes were on him, and there was potential in him, and there was a certain protection around him, like it was modulated and controlled. But the moment he stopped being relevant to the truth, because he made himself irrelevant, then suddenly the fullness of that narcissism and self arrogance has just exploded, and is now out of control. So that's one. So this is very interesting. That you know, he suddenly says he's no longer sanctimonious. The sanctimony I saw in him has disappeared. Why? Because he's no longer challenging His Highness. So let me read another story here. This was posted on the Daily Mail .co.uk, posted on that same day, the 21st of January 2024. And the headline reads, Trump calls DeSantis a, quote, terrific person, unquote, and gives Florida governor's wife, Casey, a shout out for her hard work. And he takes aim at, quote, Rhino Nikki Haley and her, quote, pro-China, pro-open borders, unquote, supporters at roaring New Hampshire rally days before primary. So now he went from being sanctimonious to being a great person. And again, what the hell happened? if there was sanctimony in DeSantis, it needs to be addressed. I'm not saying there was. I'm just saying he claimed that there was. If there was sanctimony, it needs to be addressed. But he does, no, now suddenly he went from sanctimonious to being a, quote, great person. And that, a terrific person. And that starts making you question, you know, one of his slogans is Make America Great Again. And that makes you wonder what he means by great. Because he throws the word around, great, terrific. He's thrown it around. I've seen him throw it around at people all the time. So-and-so is doing a great job. So-and-so doing a great job. I think he even said that of Fauci at some point. He's doing a great job. And I think he said that of Paul Ryan at some point. The speaker, this Irish traitor that betrayed him eventually. Well, he was always a traitor in his heart. But the thing is that he also said he's doing a great job. And I think he also has said it of Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader at the time. He's doing a great job. So he throws the word great around to the point that you wonder, what pardon my French, what the hell does he mean by making, when he says making America great again? It's like someone who comes to you and says, hey, you look great today. You know, and you go, oh, thank you. And you go, maybe I do look great today. And then he turns around to some guy who looks like hell. And he says, shakes his hand and says, you look great today. And kind of makes you wonder, you know, kind of throws, removes a little bit of the credibility to, you know, when he called you great. Like, oh, maybe I don't look so great today. Because if he called that great, then I don't know. Maybe I don't look that great. And that's the same with him, because everything is about him. You treat him nice, you're great. You treat him badly, then you're not great. And that makes you a perfect patsy for betrayal, because all you have to do to stab him in the back is tell him how great he is to his face, and then, you know, take out the knife while he's not looking, and then boom, jam it in the back. And then he starts saying, that, you know, congratulating the wife, for doing a great, all the hard work and all that. And then it says here, and then he takes aim at, quote, Rhino Nikki Haley and her, quote, pro-China, pro-open border supporters. Well, and that's one of the things I said to him in that internal debate. You know, you, what are you going to promise us, or your boss, if you're elected, if we elect you and hire you? How do we know that you're going to put the right people in the administration? Because you clearly made a terrible judgment call when you put Nikki Haley as UN ambassador, especially now that you claim that she is a globalist. So why did you put a globalist as UN ambassador? And how do we know that you're not going to continue making all these terrible errors in judgment again? And so he hired her as UN ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the UN. Why would you put a pro-China, pro-open borders, globalist hack, rhino hack, as the representative of the U.S. before the globalist organization called the U.N. If you want to stop globalism, why do you put a globalist to... I don't know if I'm making sense. It's so ridiculous, it doesn't make sense. But if you listen to him, you would think that he had never seen Nikki Haley before in his life until this Republican primary race. And why is he calling her all of that? Because she's running against him. Simple as that. That's the only reason. If she wasn't running against him, I think she'd be doing great in his eyes. She'd be wonderful. And he would be praising her time of service in the UN as UN ambassador, during his, administration. So that tells you, where this man is at. And I'm not sure what it means, you know, that he congratulated Casey, the wife of DeSantis. And I think in a certain sense, I don't know, it seems to evoke a, like a certain judgment call on the matriarchal nature of DeSantis. That's what I perceive in that, but I don't know what else to say about that. But in continuing on that, there's another article on the GatewayPundit.com posted on that same day, 21st of January, 2024, that says Trump praises Ron DeSantis and wife Casey at New Hampshire event following campaign exit and endorsement. It says here, before we begin, I'd like to take time to congratulate Ron DeSantis and, of course, a really terrific person who had gotten to know his wife, Casey, for having run a great campaign for president. He did. He ran a really good campaign. Again, the word great. He ran a great campaign. After he ridiculed him over and over again about how he was running his campaign and all that, and then suddenly he ran a great campaign. And then he did really a really good campaign. I'll tell you, it's not easy. Like, oh, it's not easy to run, come against me. I understand. You know, it's like playing Brazil, you know, in football. Of course, it's not going to be easy. Trump said, acknowledging the arduous nature of political campaigning. It's pathetic how the writer here, Jim Hoft, who was himself a moron, kind of adds like praise to the words that Trump just spoke, you know, acknowledging the arduous nature of political campaigning. Then it says here, I don't know, it still puzzles me. It's like him mentioning Casey, the wife. It's almost as if he was pointing to the matriarchal nature of, and instead of criticizing it, he was praising it. If that makes any sense. See, Ron DeSantis has a flaw, a fundamental flaw. He's a matriarchal, and even though he wants to listen to the truth, and he's listening way more than a lot of people, he is constrained by this matriarchal mindset that he has. And it's as if Trump, by praising Casey, the wife, it's as if he is praising his matriarchal nature, and almost praising it because he sees it as what led to him submitting to him finally, and recognizing, I'm the man, you're the woman. You submit to me. I'm not going to submit to you and to whatever you're questioning me about. There's something. It's very sick. When you the more you meditate on it, the more you see the sick nature. He looks very ugly on the inside. The more you peel him off, the layers of Trump, you see the ugliness in him. But not the ugliness that the liberals see. The liberals are uglier than sin themselves. So it's not that ugliness that we're talking about. It's something else. It's an ugliness that the conservatives don't see and can't see and don't want to see, are unwilling to recognize, because they're so desperate to save the country. The country's dead already, because the people who were going to save it were completely ignored by them. So another story here, and it's kind of on a related theme. This was posted on the 24th of January, 2024, on thedailymail.co.uk. And the headline reads, Trump slams his former White House press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, as a, quote, rhino, after she criticized his New Hampshire victory speech and suggested he adopt a more, quote, general election tone. unquote. So Kayleigh McEnany, I know she has an Irish surname, so you would say, okay, it's the Irish treason theme again, and there might be a bit of that, but in this particular case, I have to say, I could be wrong on this, because I would never, I really never paid attention to White House press conferences, because to me, they are an absolute waste of time. If I were president, I would eliminate that whole thing. It's a waste of money, a waste of resources, a complete waste of time. So you go there, a press secretary just, you know, they get asked a lot of lame questions, and the press secretary is forced to give all these lame answers and repeating the same thing over and over and over and over again. And there really is no new information being released. It really is an exercise in futility from a journalist perspective, from a practical government government execution of government perspective. It doesn't achieve anything in terms of making government execute its duties any better, because there's really nothing relevant or new that's being said. And these are daily press conferences, almost daily. So I would eliminate that whole practice. It's a waste of money. And if the president wants to speak, he should be there himself. If he has something really that relevant to say, something that fresh and new that needs to be said, he should be there himself. Instead of having this press secretary it always starts with this kind of broken phone type thing. Like, I don't know what he thinks, but I think that he says that, and I'll ask him. And because she's not the president, or he or she is not the president. So you're asking someone, what does someone else think about something? And why not just ask the someone else directly? It is a waste of time. It is futile. It's almost as bad, if not worse, than sport interviews. Like, you know, when they interview a player and he says, well, we're making every effort to obtain a good result and to give our best and to put it all out there, to leave it all out there on the pitch, to have victory against our opponent. So all these lame platitudes that, you know, obviously, you know, you want to beat the other team. Is that the message? Of course. That's what you're paid to do. I mean, you're trying to beat the other team. You're not telling me anything new when you say, oh, we're trying to get a good result. Obviously, you don't want to. You're not going to go try to go get a bad result, are you? So it's all these lame comments that don't add any value to anything. So that's why I don't listen to press conferences. But I do remember, like, reading or hearing a few exchanges between Kayleigh McEnany and the liberal press who would attack her, you know, because obviously they always attack a Republican or a quote conservative leaning president speaker as opposed to a liberal speaker. So they would attack her and be very harsh and mean towards her, and she would fight back. And I remember her having some very clever exchanges of like shutting them up and putting them in their place. And because of that, I, in general, had a good, and I could be wrong on this because I have the sampling is so small that I really don't know. And to be frank, I don't care to know because I don't think it's relevant, really that relevant to know all the details. But from the little sampling I have a good impression of her. It's like, and the vibe I get from her is generally positive. She might be a traitor at heart at the end, but she has a lot of good things. You know, people are complicated. But I do see a lot of good in her. She was very, very good at dealing with the liberals. So to be frank, if any, I would never, I could say there might be some bad qualities about her, I don't know, but I would never call her a rhino. She does not look like a rhino to me. It's like I know a rhino when I see one, and I see her and I don't see a rhino. So it's interesting that Trump chooses to call her a rhino. And why? Because she basically said, let me see if I can find the exact quote. Basically, all she said is she advised him to look under the hood and adopt a general election tone. I don't know if that, maybe I'm lost in the I don't have the context, but is that really that bad? Really? But see, the thing is, she was, to him, she was his employee, his servant. See, because he's an elitist. He's a king who is to be served. So he kindly picked this woman out of nowhere. She was nobody, and she put her in the spotlight as the White House press secretary for the world to see her and for her to shine before the world, thanks to the great Donald Trump. And now, instead of her just praising everything that he does and every word that he says, she has the gall, this little servant of hers, of his, to tell him what he's doing right and what he's doing wrong. And he doesn't like that at all. Just like when I was this little reporter asking him all these questions and calling him my servant, because that's what he is. If he's a public servant, he's my servant. I'm a member of the public. Ergo, he's my servant. And as my servant, I can call him out on things and tell him, you're doing this wrong, you're doing this wrong, and you need to correct this. But see, he doesn't like that because he's an elitist. So he went, you know, ballistic when McEnany dared, after she defended him so staunchly. I don't know why I keep calling Trump a her. I think there's something there. But because he's matriarchal at the end of the day, he may look bombastic and manly and masculine and over-the-top aggressive, but he's matriarchal at the end. But the thing is that McEnany kept defending him from all the wolves attacking him during the White House press conferences, ably defending him, doing all this for him. And now he turns on her and calls her, I don't know why the word bitch just came to me, but that's, I think, what he called her in his mind when he heard, I'm pretty certain that's what he said in his mind when he heard what she said about him. How dare this bitch tell me that I am not using the correct tone or saying what I need to say. And basically, I would say this was more of a praise than a criticism. If you see it in more detail, to look under the hood and adopt a general election tone. In other words, she was saying to him, hey, you've won the nomination, man. You won the nomination. So think about the general election now. Stop focusing on the primary and attacking Haley and this and that and the other, because you're it, man. You're going to win. So you would think that, you know, and maybe she's wrong. Maybe she's right. I don't know. I don't care who wins anymore. It doesn't matter to me. But what I'm trying to say is there was nothing that aggressive. It's not like she said, oh, he's a liar and he raped me or anything, you know, that scandalous. It was, no, just adopt a more general election tone. And that just sent him into anger. It says here, McEnany offered the unvarnished and apparently unwelcome advice during live commentary in Fox News on a night when Trump spent much of the New Hampshire victory speech torching rival Nikki Haley, calling her an imposter and grumbling, I don't get too angry, I get even. And then he said, I don't need any advice from Rhino Kayleigh McEnany on Fox. Trump vented online shortly before midnight on Tuesday, using an acronym for Republican in name only, Rhino. It came at a time when he might have been savoring his 12-point win in the second state to vote, which seemed to set him on a glide path to the Republican nomination, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, just had a giant victory. That's what he said. Just had a giant victory over a badly failing candidate, Bird Brain. And she, McEnany, is telling me what I can do better. Save your advice for Nikki, Trump groused. And then it says, McEnany had pointed to potential red flags for Trump on Fox and raised the prospect that Trump could face challenges in the general election. It says here, President Trump, I'd go home tonight. I'd go to my victory party. I would celebrate. I've made history yet again. But then I'd go home and I'd look under the hood. And when you look under the hood of our Fox News voter analysis data, you find that 32% of Republicans say we won't vote for Trump, she added. So I go home. If I'm Trump, I celebrate. And then I say, I've got to unite this party. I've got to win independence. That's how I beat Bite Me. That came despite McEnany calling Trump, quote, the presumptive nominee. So I don't see Rhino talk there. I see her kind of doing like, oh, there's a bigger fight coming ahead and so forth. And he's focusing on loser Nikki Haley. Basically, that's what she's saying. But no, how dare she question his strategy? So now she's a rhino in his eyes. So that means that just like the word great, like the word terrific, like the word sanctimonious, now we can include the word rhino or the expression rhino in the list of words that mean nothing when they come out of Trump's mouth. Because he only applies them. He has a bag of good labels and a bag of bad labels. It's like he has these two bags. He carries these two bags wherever he goes. And if you come towards him and call him the great one and blah, 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 then he takes out, he just reaches into the bag generously, into the bag of good labels and just starts throwing them at you. Like, without even thinking, he doesn't even look at the labels. He just throws it at you. You are wonderful. Yes, yes, you praise me, I'll praise you. But if you come and come with authority and question him and challenge him, then he reaches into his bag of bad labels and starts throwing them out. This one and this one and this one, not even thinking too clearly, just throwing them at you because you dared to question him. So no wonder he's a terrible judge of character, because you don't, that's not how you put labels on people. See, judging is putting a label on something. I mean, we all do it all the time. We have to. I mean, it's part of functioning as a thinking human being. So you judge, as I said, you'll put the label of red on a car if the car is red. You don't put the label of red on the car because the car is yours, or the car is your enemy's, or the car is coming at you to hit you, or the car is running, is going, moving away from you. It has nothing to do with the car, what the car is doing relative to you. The car is red, full stop, end of story. And that's why it deserves the red label red. If you put the label blue on it, it's a false label. No matter what your motivation is, it's still a false label because the car is red. That's what it is. So you don't choose the label based on how you feel about the car, emotionally or personally. You put the label because of what the car is. So there's that everything is all about him, and that's how he, and that's that, that you become a perfect patsy for treachery. When you think like that, and you also become a traitor, because he did an act of treason, of betrayal against McEnany. McEnany fought so hard for this man when she was in the putting up with all these nonsensical attacks against Trump from the liberal press in Washington every day, defending him and doing all these clever comebacks, you know, to get back at the liberal reporters. She did all that for him, and then suddenly he turns on her and stabs her and calls her a rhino. So that's another element of treason, when it's all about you, and when you judge everything based on how you personally feel treated. And especially if you have an elitist mindset, then suddenly you become a bad judge of character, and you become susceptible to betraying and being betrayed. Okay, so now I feel the need to say this, and it's in the context of you know, all that we've said about Trump, and it's kind of like seeing what's ahead. So let me open this link. Is it this this story is a little bit old. In other words, it's not from last week, but I think the week before. This was posted on Axios, AXIOS.com. Not too familiar with this website, but apparently it's a website about news and stuff. I'm not sure. But there was a link to this website and from a story that was posted apparently on the 13th of January 2024. The 13th of January 2024, written by Mike Allen. And the headline reads, "Iowa's frigid forecast, coldest caucus weather in decades." So it says temperatures in select Iowa cities on caucus days, and it shows, for example, Des Moines on the 15th of January, the forecast was -5. This is Fahrenheit. So I always have trouble translating that to centigrades or Celsius. So 32 is 0 Celsius, so this means 37 degrees below 32, and so you have to multiply that by 5/9. -20, if I'm doing this right. Yes, I believe so. Yeah, so it'd be -20 centigrades for those who are who live in the metric system, which is most of the world. So -5 is -20. Centigrade. It was cold. It was bitter cold. And I think I heard that with the wind chill and all that, it felt like -50 Fahrenheit, which I think would be -45 centigrade, if I'm calculating correctly. So it was bitter cold. And the weird thing is that it was cold here in the New York area as well. It got into the 20s for a few days, but it never got this cold. And it was so weird because New York is usually gets the brunt of a lot of cold weather coming down from Canada. But for some reason, the cold weather just had this weird shape, as if the truth just shaped the cold front that was coming down from Canada into the shape that, like this sort of funnel that came into the country, into the heart of the country, but missed the edges. So that's why New York did get cold weather eventually. In fact, on that day, it might not have been that cold here in New York, in the New York area. Eventually, the weather kind of moved, that cold weather air kind of moved into the area, and we had 20 degree Fahrenheit temperatures for several days. It was cold, cold. But it wasn't that cold like this. But it felt like the temperature, that cold weather focused directly on Iowa in that central part of the country. It reached all the way down into Texas, if I heard correctly. But it's as if, how can I say this? It's as if Iowa was the first place where the Republican, where the primary starts. So that's where the first place of voting happened. And it's as if the truth came in and dealt this horrible blow to the weather in Iowa as Trump was campaigning in Iowa. Now the reason why I'm mentioning this, and let's see if I have I have the link here. So this leads to this cold weather that hit Iowa exactly as it was running its having its caucus stuff. So this leads to this. This was posted on the dailymail.co.uk once again, posted on the 17th of January, 4 days after the other story. 17th of January 2024. So, just to emphasize, I do believe the weather in Iowa got cold as the caucus approached. So it got colder. It wasn't that cold, but it got colder and colder, and that cold air just descended straight into the middle of the country as the caucus got underway. In Iowa, it's a caucus, not a regular primary vote. It's a different system. It's the ridiculous nonsense we have in America, all this fragmented federalism, and it even gets manifested in our nomination system. So some places you have caucuses, some places you have general elections, in some places you have primaries where even people from the other party can vote in your party's election. It's all this nonsense of federalism, this fragmented disarray of stuff. But that's another story. The thing is that the story that I wanted to read is worn out Trump 77 sparks health fears despite resounding Iowa win as he fights to stay out of prison, save his business, and win the White House. So it says here, visibly had a hard time walking straight and appeared to be dragging his leg. Doctors say neurological issue likely not the problem, but he is clearly getting old. So I saw and they have the video of him. What happened was, you know, he won, and he was coming in from the cold. And you see him, I'm looking at it right now. Here we go. The video is starting. He's coming in into this building, and you see him like not walking straight. He's like almost like swerving to the side, like he's about to fall over. And his hair is all messed up, and you see the expression on his face. Now, if you look at it like that, and you don't know who he is, and you don't know the circumstances, you go, okay, this guy's about to fall, to have a big, he's about to, you know, to faint and fall on the ground, and he's not doing well. But you have to take into account, it was a wind chill of apparently minus 50, or whatever, it was pretty bad out there. And you're coming in from that nasty, nasty cold weather, it will affect you. And I can tell you from personal experience, I remember last year or the year before, it was one day afternoon that it was cold here in the New York area. Cold, 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 and windy. It was horrible. As Charles Barkley would say, terrible, terrible, terrible. So I was coming... I remember coming into the apartment building, and I was like, I looked like I was in a daze. I felt like I was in a daze, walking around all shaky, and it took me quite a while to warm up again. So I know what he was going through. So I don't see that as a sign that he's about to die or anything. But the fact that the video was there and it happened to me, it's a sign of what's coming to him. I know that this doesn't mean that his enemies take this and say, oh, you know, he's not well, and he's criticizing Bite Me, but he's also getting old and sickly. But I see this. Remember what we said last time, you know, he is cursed. He is cursed. The son of a bitch is cursed. And we release that into the atmosphere. And then he has this moment of almost like a tree that is about to topple over. Because he was hit. It's like a punch came at him and he felt the punch. And strong as he thinks he is, he thinks he's an oak tree. But the punch came and left him wavering. Despite his victory, despite everything, he is about to topple over. And this is a sign of what's coming to him. The other story I wanted to mention is it was posted on the 17th of January on the GatewayPundit.com. And it reads, left-wing media freaks over mysterious red marks on Trump's hand, Democrat strategist James Carville claims it looks like syphilis. And James Carville is a moron, so who cares what he says. But yeah, so he's waving. There's a picture of Trump waving, and in his hands there's these red marks on it. And then, you know, everybody who hates him, but hates him in the wrong way, you know, starts speculating all these stupid things, just like Carville, say, oh, he must have syphilis because, you know, he's a pervert. Because, the same guy who's James Carville worked, was a campaign person for Clinton. So maybe that's where he gets his expertise on syphilis. I don't know. But it's kind of ironic that he wants to throw the label around at Trump when he worked for someone who was clearly a sexual miscreant. So and that goes to the same thing about the labels, the bag of good labels and the bag of bad labels. It's almost the same thing, only in this case it's being applied to him, to Trump. So there are these red marks, and I can see them, and it does make you think, because one of them looks like almost like a blister, like a nasty hole, like a sore hole in his finger. But turns out, and I don't have the link to that, but another story came out some days later that apparently those red marks on his fingers were on his upper palm and his thumb and his index finger were from a paper cut he had had. He had a paper cut, and he must not have felt it too much, and it was bleeding, and it kind of stained his hand a bit. He didn't realize it. And they mentioned that in that other story that there's a picture of him, him waving later that day or the very next day, I forget, and the red stains were gone. So they were not like sores. They were just blood stains, tiny blood stains from some sort of paper cut that he had. So that's why they washed off rather easily. So it was not syphilis. It was not like he had some sort of infectious disease or something. But it's a sign what's coming to him. This is not a coincidence. You know, first he has the, you know, almost toppling over video where he looked very weak, you know, coming in from the cold in Iowa. Very bad. I mean, if you saw the video, you would see it. If you didn't know the context, you would think he's about to faint. And he looks very bad. Like, he looks like a frail old man. Very bad. And now you see this, that there is blood on his hand, literally. and now he looks like he has syphilis. And it's like another hit on him that this is what's coming to him. He's going down. He thinks he's strong. He thinks he's healthy, figuratively and literally, and that he's unbeatable, but he's going down. And I know it's not, this is a sign, the consequences of treachery. He's a traitor to the truth. He's a traitor to what he was called to do. Now he's attacking anyone who dares to question him, anyone. And a person like that becomes unreachable, because if you can't tell you, no one can tell you what you're doing wrong, then you'll never correct what you're doing wrong. So he is beyond repair now, because he's not just going to reject what you have to say, he's going to reject what you have to say and take out his sword and come kill you for having dared to tell him what he did wrong. And that kind of makes you think of the kings of old, you know, who would take criticism very badly. Or not take it very nicely, and they would behead anyone who dared to question what they had to say. So that's that. And so now the other thing we want to mention, and I think time is running short here, Speaking of Trump, this is another story that came out on the 26th of January, 2024. And so that's the date before this recording. And it's on the gatewaypundit.com. And it says, New York changed laws to enable crackpot E. Jean Carroll to sue Trump. E. Jean Carroll admits she helped Democrats pass the law so they could get Trump. So what's happening is that Trump has been in the midst of this of these trials, lots of trials, and yeah, because the Democrats are using, as DeSantis mentioned in his short video, lawfare. They're using law in the legal system to wage warfare against their political enemies, and he opposed that too. He mentioned that he was opposed to that. In other words, he was saying this is wrong, even if it's coming against my opponent, Trump. So see, he takes a little bit of a different stance. He tries to judge things. DeSantis tries to judge things based on what they are, not on whether they're for him or against him. But regardless, the thing is that it says here. Well, the thing is, Trump has been in these trials, and one involves this crazy woman. Evil woman, E. Jean Carroll, who suddenly came out of the woodwork claiming that she was raped by him many years ago. I mean, so many years ago, she can't even sue him, I think, in criminal court. But she came out with the story because the idea was to, try to destroy Trump by destroying his credibility. And that's what Democrats do. If they want to destroy you, they try to hire a woman or get a woman to say that you raped her or that you slept with her or that you had an affair with her or that you were harassing her sexually and blah blah blah, you know, all these stories, and that's how they attack people. That's one of their favorite tactics. So they dredged up this woman, E. Jean Carroll, or maybe she offered volunteer her services to say, let's destroy Trump, so I'm going to claim that he raped me. And apparently, if I'm not mistaken, she sued him, apparently it was established by some judge, and Trump didn't attend that trial, that yes, indeed, he had raped her. And so, legally speaking, apparently, it's already a established verdict and fact, quote-unquote, that he raped her. And now there's another trial of defamation, because she wrote a book talking about how he had raped her and all that. And Trump criticized that and said, I don't know the woman, and she's crazy, she's a nut job liberal, and blah, 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 you know, and all of that's valid. So this time he's grabbing out of the bag correctly. But again, he's grabbing out of the bad labels bag because she's coming against him. But, you know, just by coincidence, just by pure chance, this time he is throwing the right labels at the person. But the thing is that, so he started criticizing her and calling her all these names that she deserves. And then she sued him ridiculous amount of money, like millions of dollars for defamation, because he dared to question her claim that she raped him, that he raped her. So now that's the other trial that he's involved in, and that's the trial that's being mentioned here. So it says here, as D.C. Drano pointed out earlier today, E. Jean Carroll wasn't only funded by a Democrat activist billionaire to smear Trump in court, but she also helped New York officials, quote, change state laws to specifically allow her to attack Trump right before the 2024 election. And Trump hater George Conway helped push her to file the outrageous claims against President Trump. So George Conway is the husband of a chief of staff, I think it was, Kellyanne Conway, that Trump hired to have in the White House. And again, it starts to make you question. And we criticized him a long time ago for choosing her because I could be wrong on this, but I think that Conway is an Irish surname as well. And I kept saying there's Irish, either literal or figurative treachery there. Maybe not directly from her, but there's something wrong with having her around. And her husband is a Trump hater. So again, it just goes to that question of Trump's ability to judge people's character. So George Conway helped her push her to file the outrageous claims against Trump. E. Jean Carroll went on CNN with her attorney Roberta Kaplan to brag about how Carroll was only able to file the lawsuit after New York Democrats changed the laws and extended the statute of limitations for sexual assault in the state. This allowed E. Jean Carroll to sue Trump for a rape she said took place in a department store sometime in the 1990s during a shopping spree with the younger Donald Trump. She didn't even have to give a date or a year to get the case to court in New York City. Quote, Governor, and I say that in quotes, it's not in quotes in the article, but I say it in quotes. Quote, Governor Hochul, that's the bitch that's in Albany acting as, quote, Governor of New York, New York State. Governor Hochul signed the act into law in May 2022 so that E. Jean Carroll could file her lawsuit against Trump. So, and it was passed on May 24th, 2022. It says here, Carroll could not win a rape case against Trump, so her team took him to court for, quote, defamation for the comments he made as president. This sets a dangerous precedent for future presidents as the left continues its assault on the First Amendment. The Trump jury in the E. Jean Carroll defamation trial returned a verdict on Friday, $7.1 million, or $11 million plus punitive $65 million in damages. So that, so now, the reason why I'm bringing this up is, first of all, it's a sign of what's coming to Trump, the fall. He is going to fall pretty badly. He's been cursed. You know, it's like the thing, the Herod thing that we were mentioning the other time. He went over the top when he said, we have to make concessions when it comes to abortion. And we explained why that was so wrong. And that's why he is not the one he never was the one who would save the country, because he's always been compromised. And he's even willing to compromise on that, because that's how you win elections. That's how he said it. So yeah, let's sacrifice some fetuses. It's fine. It's fine. You know, it's like Lincoln saying, well, yeah, let's sacrifice some slaves. Let's leave some slaves around. If that saves the Union, you know, that's how you win elections. That's why he had Andrew Johnson as vice president, the Democrat racist bigot. He had him as vice president because he wanted to win the election in 1864. That's why he took out Hamlin and put in that bastard. And then Lincoln, son of a bitch, got his head blown off. And then Andrew Johnson took over as president, and then made life hell for the people, for black people in the South. So yes, he did exactly the same thing that Trump is doing. The only difference is Trump is doing it with abortion. Lincoln did it with slavery and black people. So Lincoln was willing to sell black people down the river, literally and figuratively. And Trump is figuratively willing to sell fetuses down the river if it means winning elections. That's how. So instead of trying to convince the American people, hey, this is why abortion is wrong, and explain, you know, from a fundamental philosophical perspective, why it's wrong and what we need to change in our legal system to really bring to life the right to life in the legal system. Instead of doing any of that, it's like, no, let's be practical about it. Let's compromise. So the moment he did that, he was a deeper level of cursing came upon him. And that's why he's going down, just like Herod in the Bible, as it's described in Acts chapter 12, I think it is. He's going down hard. And this is part of all these blows that he's receiving left and right. And the thing is that this also points to the betrayal that we have, and that's what we wanted to get to eventually, the treachery and betrayal that is coming from the judiciary branch. There's a spirit or mindset of just the outright betrayal that has come through the judiciary branch in the American system. And it's all because of the founding father's stupidity and not defining the boundaries. The judicial branch is like a king. No one can question the judicial branch. There are no balance. There's no balance of no checks and balances between the judiciary branch and any other branch. Between the legislative and executive branch in America, yeah, the founding fathers in their wisdom left the system of veto and veto overriding, where the president can veto a bill, and the Congress can override the veto by 60% majority. They vote on the bill again and they get 60%, then they can override the veto. So there's a way for one to upend the other in one form or another. Oh, and by the way, when they did that, you say, oh, that was so clever. But then there's also the pocket veto that they never thought of, where the president says, oh, he has the bill on the table, but he's not signing it. But are you going to veto it? No. Are you going to sign it? No, not yet. And that way, he just keeps the bill on the table, and it never gets approved, but he never officially vetoes it. And as long as he doesn't officially veto it, the Senate cannot come along, or the Congress cannot override his veto, because there's no veto to override. So that's a very clever loophole that presidents have used in the past, including the son of a bitch Lincoln, to prevent the balance of the check and balance to work. So again, these wise founding fathers didn't really think it out, think it through completely. And when we started running into the pocket veto, instead of saying, hey, there's a problem in the system here, let's fix this, let's introduce something to fix this gap that the founding fathers left, no, we just keep living with it. And every time something gets exposed in our constitutional system that shows, hey, the founding fathers weren't that wise and that brilliant, they clearly didn't think it through. Instead of saying, hey, let's fix it. Okay, you know, they were human, they were imperfect, whatever excuse you want to give. Okay, whatever. But let's fix it. I don't care if you love or hate the founding fathers, at least fix what they did wrong. Just fix it. I don't care if you still put up a statue to them and candles. Well, I do care in a sense, but that's not my concern. My concern is that your candles and your statues are going to make you not want to fix the thing. So in that sense, I do care that you put up a statue and a candle and all that and worship these guys, because then eventually that will get to you siding with them versus the truth. So, but the thing is, regardless of what you think about them, let's fix the goal, the gaps in the hole, the gaps, the holes that they left in our system. But no. We just keep living with the same thing over and over again. And we have a judiciary branch that's going out of control because it was never defined properly in the Constitution. So now the judiciary branch can decide something and no one can veto it. You can't have Congress say, we're going to veto what you just said. If the legal the judicial branch decides that a law is unconstitutional, the law is unconstitutional. No one can say, no, let's override that, or let's have a national referendum, something to have the people overturn the decision of one man or nine people sometimes. It's like, how can one person decide for the whole country? And in a way that we cannot control or overturn in any way, shape, or form. So they become the supremes, the supreme power in the land, and they are using it constantly for betrayal. So now you have this ridiculous 80 million or 65 million in damages. For what? Her feelings were hurt? What? Because he defamed her? Because he called her a witch and or maybe a bitch, and she deserves all those labels? But and see, the labels are valid if he didn't rape her. But we can't establish that. But it's like saying, I come in and accuse someone of being a murderer, and then the person says, oh, he's crazy. And then I sue the guy for having called me crazy and hurting my feelings. Well, there is no defamation if what was said about me was true. So if he's calling me a liar and a crazy liar because I'm claiming that he committed a murder that he didn't commit, then there is no defamation. But in this case, she's claiming that her feelings were hurt, but we can only validate her hurt feelings if she really was raped. But where is the evidence that she was raped? There is no evidence of it, of anything. It's just because he said hurtful words. Hurtful, but if they're true, who cares if they hurt or not? When she's calling him a rapist, and I would think that would hurt anyone's feelings if they're called a rapist. But because he's not reacting based on feelings, but reacting based on fact, then it's no longer a matter of hurt feelings. So she can call him a rapist, and no one's feelings get hurt. No, and Trump cannot sue her for defamation. But she can sue him because he called her a crazy liar for claiming that she raped him. It is ridiculous. And where do the $65 million come from? And we've talked about this before. The legal, the judicial system is so distorted and so treacherous now that they pull out these numbers out of nowhere. And we've complained about this all the time throughout for years. It's been a reality that we all know about in the American system, all this stupidity about this $1 million of compensation for anything, but no one does anything about it. How can we quantify $65 million in damages of hurt feelings? What is that? What is that? Where does that number come from? And we have never bothered to set a system where we can define exactly, you know, how do we make sense of these amounts? Like, what's his name? Alex Jones, I think his name is, who got sued and has to pay $2.1 billion in damages because he said something that hurt the feelings of some parents, the parents of some kids that died in a massacre. He said something, and now it's $2.1 billion. And then he apologized a few days later, but still, no. He hurt my feelings. He has to pay $2.1 billion. And he wasn't even the gunman. I mean, I don't know if the gunman is dead. I forget what happened with the shooter, the Sandy Hook shooter. But I don't think they would ever sue that guy for $2.1 billion. But they sue Alex Jones. Why? Because they don't like him. So they want to destroy him financially, and they use that as a mechanism. And I think the parents who sued were liberals, diehard, crazy, nutjob liberals. And they just used this as a strategy to attack, destroy someone they don't like. But Where does that amount come from? $2.1, $65 million. All that's ridiculous. And we've never bothered to sit down and fix it. And why is also there no political will to fix this? Because, as we've said before, and it makes sense, the majority of people in politics are lawyers. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a natural thing. You know, people who are into law are naturally drawn into politics. It's natural. It's understandable. But the problem is, because these politicians are for the most part lawyers, they have a vested interest in the lawyer profession being profitable. So they would never pass a law to curtail profits, you know, in the legal industry, because it's an industry now. Because it would affect them in their personal lives because they have an affinity for the lawyer profession because they come from it. So, and they want to have a nice profitable profession to go back to if the, you know, their political career doesn't pan out or runs out of steam. But as we've said before, one of the fundamental changes that needs to be done is to turn the lawyer profession into a service profession, in the sense that it's one of the professions that will be tagged as being limited in terms of income. You can only make 1.5 or maybe twice the or maybe 1.5 times the national average. If the national household makes $60,000 a year, a lawyer cannot have an income of higher than $90,000. For being a lawyer, and also have these strong restrictions on to prevent, you know, the people trying to get around that limit. Like, I don't make more than $90,000 as a lawyer, but I get invited to speak at some university and I get paid $5 million just for speaking for a couple of days. So, you know, that sort of runaround. And if we can, you know, and someone who has good thinking will be able to put limits on that, you know, to make sure that there are no loopholes that people can use. But we should have a profession where lawyers can not make money, and they cannot profit from verdicts. It is inherently wrong and corrupt, and morally, ethically wrong for lawyers to make a percentage of the damages that they win for their clients, because no one should profit from the law. See, if you're serving the law, you're a public servant, you're serving truth, you're doing the right thing. But the thing is, the lawyer knows that they will get 30% of the cut if they can get $65 million in damages from a jury. And the jury doesn't have to do anything. They just vote, make a decision, and then because the money's not coming out of their pockets, they can pull any number out of their butt. And they don't have to give an account for it. No one. There is no accountability for the numbers that these stupid juries or judges come up with, because it's not their money anyway. So they can just manipulate emotions and manipulate juries and get all this money, and then they get 30% of the cut. That is wrong. And then there's no incentive to change the law so that these unfair verdicts, to curtail these unfair verdicts. A lawyer should not be able to get a cut of anything. They should just be paid by the hour. And they cannot make more than $90,000 a year. Oh, that's not enough to live. Well, yes, it is more than enough to live. And if you can't live on that, then just go do something else with your life. Engage in some profitable business where you can make lots of money, but don't do it off of the legal system. So that tells you, you know, the corruption of the system. And again, when there's ambiguity, it opens the ground, or opens the door for treachery to emerge. And this is how the legal system is now, the judicial system in America has turned into a system of treason, of treachery, through which betrayal is just seeping in into the American culture, into the American society, through the judicial branch, because it was so ambiguous, so ambiguously defined by the moron founding fathers. The other thing here is that this also points to the problem with federalism. Because see, all that they needed to do is find one state that was Democrat, blue state, deep blue state, controlled by the Democrats. Because federalism leads to internal, and federalism combined with the party system that we've described before leads to these pockets of party localized party corruption. So they want to destroy a national figure. They just pick a state. They go to the state and say, let's change the laws here. And now it's okay to file a lawsuit, a rape lawsuit about something that happened 25 years ago that no one can prove or disprove. And so forth. So the thing is that as that shows how federalism, the fact that there is no effort to standardize truth, the law across the land, because then you can have these pockets of where people manipulate laws for their own political ends. And so if you have a blue state controlled by the corrupt Democrats, they can manipulate the laws to then do damage to whoever they want. And they don't have to give accountability to any other state, because no other state can say, hey, New York, why are you changing the laws on the statute of limitations for rape? Why is it, if the rape happens in New York, you have so many more years to you know, of in your statute of limitations, but if the rape happens just, you know, on the other side of New York, on, let's say, I think Pennsylvania and New York do border each other in parts of parts of New York and Pennsylvania do touch. But so if a rape happens on the other side in Pennsylvania, then the statute of limitations will run out much faster. Why? It's the same rape. Why would it? It makes no sense. We've talked about this before. If I kill someone on the Louisiana side of the border, I get a certain sentence. But if person A kills person B on the other side, on the side of Texas, on the Texas side of the border, then it's a different penalty. Why would I get 20 years? Why would a person get 20 years for killing someone on one side practically imaginary line, and get 5 years if he does it on the other side of the line? It's the same murder. Why is it different? So because we live in this system of federalism, then the laws are non-homogeneous. There's no effort to standardize, no effort to find the truth. What is the exact number of years that we should penalize someone for a certain type of murder? It doesn't matter. Everyone decides what they want at the state level because it's federalism. And then that opens the door for this. Then they can gang up on and gather in one state and collude in that one state and manipulate things in that one state and then do things that affect not only that state, but all the other states, because now they're going after a national candidate, not just a candidate in the state of New York. So it just goes to show how federalism is stupid. It's just outright stupid. And conservatives complain, you know, it's a conservative who wrote this article complaining about how terrible the system is and how unfair it is to Trump. And I agree. But none of them sit down and they even explain how New York State changed its laws. So they write it down, but they never stop and say, okay, doesn't this make federalism a little bit of a problem? No, they never go there, because, oh, God forbid that they would question the Founding Fathers. It just shows the utter stupidity that we're in. It shows, you know, how all these ambiguities that the Founding Fathers left open the door for betrayal, and how federalism, this fractionalization of the truth, that's what federalism is. Let's divide the truth into 50 regions, and each region defines truth as whatever the hell they want, and these states, as per the 11th Amendment, have more value than the rights of individuals, as we've explained. if you've heard that audio snippet from way long ago about the 11th Amendment. That's what the 11th Amendment basically says. The rights of the individual are secondary to the rights of the state, state, as in the state of Virginia or state of South Carolina and so forth. So when you fractionalize the truth, then you enable betrayal, because you allow the traitors to gather and work together in one region to plot the treachery against other people. And then this also highlights the what's coming to Trump. He may think he's strong. He feels like a champion now. He's almost all by himself in the Republican thing, primary. But he's going down. He is going down, and it's inevitable. He is absolutely no reason for hope, or he's no savior. He's not the rescuer of this nation. The country is dead. And the fact that people still support him, and that they are willing to say the things that we're saying in these recordings, it's just greater evidence that there is not enough material in this country to make it worthy of salvation, because it's a country that at the end of the day betrayed the truth. They decided to honor their founding fathers more than the truth. The conservatives and the liberals they just didn't care for the truth to begin with. So they are willing to stab anyone who comes with the truth at them. And that's why the country's dead. So if allowed, we will continue talking about the judicial branch and how it's become a place of treachery. But we'll talk about things related to the border and that again point to the problems of federalism and the problems of the judicial branch being so poorly defined. But we'll do that in the next audio snippet. And again, it will always all be in the context of betrayal and treachery, which seems to be the theme running across the land at this point. So thank you very much for listening. And we'll continue the next audio snippet. Thank you very much.